This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Diane Keaton has starred in a series of dramas and comedies that are now American classics, like The Godfather Trilogy and some of Woody Allen's most popular films, including the title role in Annie Hall. She won an Oscar for Best Actress in that film and is up for another one this weekend for her leading role opposite Jack Nicholson in the romantic comedy Something's Gotta Give. Keaton's other films include Marvin's Room, First Wives Club, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Reds, and Father of the Bride. She directed the films Heaven and Unstrung Heroes. In Something's Gotta Give, Keaton earned her latest Oscar nomination by playing a woman whose daughter is dating a much older man, played by Jack Nicholson. Nicholson's character, Harry, has a heart attack, and Keaton's character, Erica, ends up being his host as he recuperates. This scene, which has them making pancakes together, hints at the unexpected but genuine attraction they're beginning to feel for one another.
You know what you're like? You're like one of those great portraits you see over a fireplace. Words have been invented to describe women like you.
Such as?
Flinty.
Oh.
And impervious.
So you think I'm inhuman?
No. I think you're formidable.
Yeah, cold, distant, like I'm frozen in some painting?
Not at all, but I do think that you use your strength to separate yourself from everyone. But it's thrilling when your defenses are down and you're not isolated. That, I believe, is your winning combo. Killer combo, actually.
You know, I can't decide if, oh God, if you hate me or if, you're like the only person who ever really got me.
I don't hate you.
Terry spoke with Diane Keaton in 1997, just as her film Marvin's Room was being released. That movie, too, had her playing a woman who was caring for an ill man. In that movie adaptation of the stage play, Keaton and Meryl Streep play sisters with opposite temperaments. Keaton plays Bessie, who has dedicated her life to taking care of her father ever since a stroke left him bedridden. Meryl Streep plays Lee, who has cut herself off from the family to establish an independent life. After Bessie is diagnosed with leukemia, Lee comes home to visit for the first time in many years, and Bessie confronts her.
Lunch. Why can't you take Dad and Ruth?
I don't think so.
You could move down here. You could have the house.
No, I got Hank to think about.
He's very unhappy there.
Of course he's unhappy. If he were happy, he wouldn't be there.
You could have him transferred. You could find a very nice place for him here. You could have the whole house. You could have the sunshine. You could find work down here.
Lee? No.
Why not?
Just. No.
Well, then give me one good reason.
Because I don't want to. I made this decision once already. When Daddy had his first stroke, I made this decision then. I was not going to waste my life.
You think I've wasted my life?
God, of course not.
I can't imagine a better way to have spent my life.
Well, then we both made the right decision.
What decision? Dad got sick and I came down to help out for a little while. You didn't.
I had plans. I had a husband. I couldn't come down.
You didn't come down. And what makes you think for a second that I didn't have plans? You know, you're just the most...
Come on, say it. Say it, say it. You've been saying it a million different ways since I first came down
here.
Leave
her alone. What are you yelling at her for?
She wants to tell you what a terrible person I am. I have been over backwards to be nice to you from the moment you walked in that door.
That's right. You are nice to me when you want something.
What are you talking about?
Oh, come on, Hank. You think your Aunt Bessie's being nice to you all of a sudden because she, what, felt an urge?
Shut up.
Oh, come on, come on. Listen, did you ever get a birthday present from your Aunt Bessie?
I thought about you all the time. It's just...
How about a card? Did you ever get a card from your Aunt Bessie?
We were not... close. We were.
You didn't speak to me for 20 years.
You're supposed to take care of your family.
I took care of my family. I raised two kids all by myself. Never even heard from you people. Now I am finally getting my life together. Nobody's going to take it away from me.
Your role in Marvin's Room is really the opposite of the kind of role we first got to know you from in your Woody Allen movies. Mm-hmm. Your character of Bessie is somebody who, first of all, dresses in very kind of Kmart-type fashions.
Literally.
Lives in a very sheltered world, is steadfast in her devotion to her family, mm-hmm. and has very little of a life outside of that. She's the kind of person who doesn't leave home, was never mm-hmm. left home. Nothing is couched in irony. And many of your other characters, well, particularly in the Woody Allen movies, there's so many things that have quotation marks around them. And I guess I'm interested in what it's like to inhabit both of those worlds through your roles. You know, the character who doesn't live in a world of irony, and then the character who does.
It's easier for me to be in the world of the ironic because it sort of comes more naturally to me. I had trouble with this part regarding certain primary scenes, and I'm talking about the part of Bessie in Marvin's room. I would go up to the director and say, do you know that last scene? I don't know if you saw this, Terry, but the last scene where, well, obviously you did. You had to, probably. Anyway, the last scene.
I did,
I have to say to Meryl, I'm so lucky to have loved so much. I'm so lucky. You know, I really, literally couldn't say that because it's dead on, flat on, the truth, the feeling of the moment, the depth of that moment. And I remember the director saying, no, Diane, you have to say that. You have to say those lines. And I was going, no, because listen, let me tell you something. As far as I'm concerned, if somebody called me up, if somebody doctor called me up and said, guess what, nothing's working, and yeah, you are going to die, I couldn't sit there and get down on the floor and pick up those pills and say to my sister, I'm so lucky to have loved so much. I'm so lucky. I said, I would be terrified. No, 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 that's not the intention. And because really, the heart of the piece is in that. You know, it's right there in those lines at the end there. And I was fighting it. And Meryl Streep came up into my room and she told me also in a very kind way that this is someplace I have to try and go and imagine. Of course, I can't imagine it. But on the other hand, you have to kind of get swept away. And one of the reasons I think that I was helped was, of course, because of Meryl, because somehow being and looking into Meryl's face, she just kind of lifted me up and helped me go there. But frankly, it's not easy for me. It's just not easy.
Tell me what was so difficult about saying, I'm so lucky to have loved so much.
It's just so hard for me to imagine that someone says to you, you're going to die, and then 2 minutes later, you look at your sister and you say, I'm so grateful to have been able to love, instead of thinking, my God. I mean, I would be in a panic. I would be in a complete panic. I could cry with her, and like I could do the scene with her where I say, I'm afraid, you know, if I close my eyes, I'll never wake up. That I got. I mean, I get that. Spades, you know, hands down, that's easy for me. But the other is hard to imagine being that kind of a person. I guess I'm shallow.
No, but let me ask you this. How do you decide with lines like that whether there's something that doesn't ring true about the script or whether it's just that you're a different kind of person than the character?
No, I think that it did ring true with the script. I think I did have to say those lines because I think that that's the kind of person she is at the core, that she can leave it and she can accept the fact that she's going to be leaving everybody permanently. So in that case, I really think as I was just begging for help, and I got help. I think that I'm afraid. I think I'm kind of a chicken actress, and I think that people really have to keep saying, you can do it, you can do it. And it really tells you. I mean, as an actress, it really informs me how much I desperately need a director who cares. It's so important to have somebody watching me. And lots of times it's easy for me to give up. And, you know, my tendency is to just kind of rush through everything. Like, I love to be fast. My favorite thing in life is to be speedy and quick and get through it. But I think they said no. And that was another thing that Jerry Zaks would say to me, take the moment. And I'd be going, oh, get out of here. You know, I mean, what is he talking about? He's nuts. I did take that moment. You know, I mean, you constantly are battling with yourself when you're acting in a part. At least I am, because it's just not that easy for me.
Yeah.
I think that I'm more inclined to live comfortably in the world of humor.
Diane Keaton, your mother was a beauty queen, yes?
No. No, here's what she was. Although she is very beautiful, by the way. No, she was Mrs. Los Angeles. That's entirely different. It means that when I was growing up in the 50s, we lived in Highland Park in Los Angeles. And I remember I was about 8 or 9, and my mother, you know, became Mrs. Highland Park. And I remember sitting down in the stage and watching her being crowned Mrs. Highland Park. And it was that she was the perfect homemaker. I went to win Mrs. Highland Park. She kept making these chocolate cakes every day that we had to eat. And this was, you know, this was what she was. And then she went on to be Mrs. Los Angeles because she made a good spaghetti or something. I don't know. And they came around at like 7 in the morning, the judges, and looked at our house, which was insane to see if she was a neat homemaker. And so that was very exciting for about, I think it lasted for about 4 months. And but then she made it to the finalists of Mrs. California, but then she didn't get Mrs. California. She was too good for him. She was too good for him.
What did she win when she won Mrs. Highland Park?
Oh, appliances. Oh, please. You know, just the best appliances ever and, you know, luggage and all those great things.
Did you want to be a happy homemaker?
No. No, I did not want to be a happy homemaker. Uh-uh. That did not appeal to me. But I did want to go on stage. I saw that that was something that did appeal to me. There she was in the theater, and I saw the curtain open, and there was my mother. And I thought, I think I like that for myself.
It's funny, so you kind of got the wrong message here.
I got the total wrong message.
She was,
how like life.
Yeah, she was presented as the picture of domesticity, and you interpreted that as show business.
Oh, yeah. Leave it to me.
One of your early roles was in Hair, and every profile I've read of you, every written profile...
Yeah, I didn't take off my clothes.
Exactly. Every profile mentions that during the nude scenes or nude scenes in Hair, that when everybody else was naked, you were wearing a body stocking. And I couldn't help but wonder if the cast...
No, I wasn't wearing a body stocking. No, no. The situation was that we were all under this huge tarp or something doing, you know, and we were lying there, and there would be holes in the tarp, and people would stand up at the appropriate moment. And you sort of just stand naked. That was how that was. And I just remember lying under the tarp and seeing all my friends get naked over the course of time. And I just didn't want to do it. It just didn't seem worth it to me at the time. I didn't want to do it. Standing naked in the dark and getting cold, you know, it just didn't seem like fun.
So
reason I didn't do it. It just, you know, it wasn't worth it.
So how did you avoid doing it?
I didn't. It wasn't a requirement by any means.
Oh, okay.
It was optional, and it was suggested, and you would get $50 extra.
No.
It's a money gig. It was a money gig. It's like everything else.
That's funny. So did anybody in the cast kind of make fun of the people who were not willing to take their clothes off?
Not really, but it was sort of get behind the spirit of it all. But, hey, frankly, I was, you know, I just graduated from the Neighborhood Playhouse, and I really wasn't a hippie. I never was a hippie. I was basically always an actress. And so I just didn't really get behind it in terms of the spirit of the moment. And besides, we were all in show business. I never believed that it was like, you know, peace, love, and happiness.
Diane Keaton speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. Keaton is up for an Academy Award for her role in the film Something's Gotta Give. More with Keaton after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Diane Keaton. But first, here's a scene from Annie Hall.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
You mean, no, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. If you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't... I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah. Would you like a lift?
Sure. Which way are you going?
Me? Downtown.
I'm going uptown.
Oh, well, you know, I'm going uptown, too.
No, wait a minute. You just said you were going downtown.
Yeah, well, but I can...
I'm sorry.
I can go uptown, too. I live uptown, but what the hell? I mean, it'd be nice having company, you know? I mean, I hate driving alone.
Now, the inflections that you used in Annie Hall, a voice that's often speaking in irony, a voice that has a lot of insecurity in it as well as humor. How did you come up with that inflection?
Well, that I didn't even come up with it. I just delivered it. It was just there. I think that was something that he trusted and enjoyed. Did you happen to read that profile on him in The New Yorker?
No.
That was interesting because Diane Weiss was talking about him. And if something isn't working, he's very simple about why it isn't working. Well, with Annie Hall, when I was doing Annie Hall, everything seemed to be working. He just didn't question it. We were going with kind of the spontaneous impulses that we were feeling at the time in those scenes, and we just let it rip. I think Diane Wiest was saying, you know, in Bullets Over Broadway, when she won the Academy Award, that that character wasn't happening, and he called her up, and he said, it's no good. And she didn't know what to do. She didn't know. And he said, he came up with an idea, and he said, think's your voice. Let's just lower it. Do you believe it? It's that simple. And then she had it. She had the character, and it was amazing. I mean, she's amazing anyway. But what I'm saying is it was a very simple solution to what a lot of people would have made a very complicated problem. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He just cuts through all the time in every way.
Was your inflections and your voice in Annie Hall a voice that you really spoke in, or is it the voice of the character that you found, and what was your process of finding it?
No, I think I spoke in that character at that point in my life.
Oh, okay.
I think that's the way I talked.
Did you say la-di-da?
never did say that, though. That he wrote.
Was that on the page? I mean, if I saw la-di-da on the page, I think, oh, man, this is never going to work. And, of course, it really works terrifically. Did you think?
I think it's because it worked, because I think that there was this, it was the way we were working. In other words, it's how he directs, which is to loosen it up, just to loosen the whole thing up. And just fly with it. And then it worked. I know, that doesn't seem like a very good line, does it? La-di-da.
Well, it wouldn't to me on the page. It really
no.
would not.
Mm-mm.
But it does in the movie.
It worked, yeah.
Now, I want to ask you about the Godfather movies. You're in all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in particularly in the first two movies, you're the woman in a world of men. And
I mean, it's such a funny. Yes, I was. I was the woman in a world of men.
And that's really brought home at the end of the first Godfather movie where Al
Pacino, it's a great moment,
yeah,
isn't it?
Slams the door in your face and makes it really clear that now that he's the head of the family,
he's the head,
you're going to be shut out of a lot of his life.
Oh, it's a world I know nothing about. Do you know, when we were making it, it was just, I didn't know what was going on, and I just did feel left out. I really felt that way. And I also felt, I never understood why he cast me in that, ever. I still don't understand why he cast me in that. I never thought, you know, at that point in my life, people viewed me as being kind of kooky. You know, I was like the kooky actress. And he cast me in that role.
Right.
So you're serious.
Yes, and sensible, down to earth, practical.
I'm telling you, it's nothing. I never got it. And he never, I don't know what made him pick me. That was a lucky break.
What was your audition?
Because I'm really glad to be part of that, those movies.
Oh,
I'm proud
boy.
To be part of it.
I can only imagine how much. Yeah.
Yeah, but they were a mystery to me. They still are a mystery to me. That's a world I really don't understand. I do understand what she was like, feeling left out.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes that. That's a horrible thing. It's a cold thing.
So in what ways did you feel maybe kind of left out or the outsider on the Godfather sets?
I think in every way I felt the outsider. There was nobody that really became my friend on those movies. I guess I really
What about Al Pacino, though? You had a relationship with him.
But it wasn't like we palled out.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't, do you know what I mean? He was very private and separate from me. And then the first one, I really didn't know him very well. And I think he was also overwhelmed by the enormity of his part. And he was so profoundly, I think, great in that movie. I think when he has to murder for the first time, I think that's a very amazing performance he gave.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really a loner. He was really involved with that part. He was separate from the other guys, I felt. And he was in the movie, too. But I just didn't know what the hell was going on. I was, 23? I didn't know anything about movies. I was overwhelmed by the entire enterprise. I really was.
You said you had no idea why Coppola gave you the part. What was your audition like? What had he seen of you?
I don't know. I have no idea. I came in, I auditioned like everybody else. I don't know what it was that he saw in me to cast me instead of Jill Clayburgh. Or whoever else was up. I remember she was up for it. And she and I were kind of similar at that time. We were sort of, you know, together, up for the same parts and things like that. I don't know. I really don't know. I think Michelle Phillips was up for it. I think, who else was up for it? I don't know.
What did you
all the gals at that time, I'm sure, were up for that part.
I'll change. I've learned that I have the strength to change. Then you'll forget about this miscarriage. And we'll have another child. And we'll go on. You and I. We'll go on.
Oh, Michael. Michael, you are blind. It wasn't a miscarriage. It was an abortion. An abortion, Michael. Just like our marriage is an abortion. Something that's unholy and evil. I didn't want your son, Michael. I wouldn't bring another one of your sons into this world. It was an abortion, Michael. It was a son, and I had it killed because this must all end. I know now that it's over. I knew it then. There would be no way, Michael, no way you could ever forgive me. Not with this Sicilian thing that's been going on for 2,000 years. Oh!
You won't take my children.
I will.
You won't take my children!
You're much.
Diane Keaton speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. Keaton is up for an Academy Award for her role in the film Something's Gotta Give. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Bill Murray broke into television playing wise guys and goofy characters on Saturday Night Live and broke into movies the same way. In Caddyshack, he was a human cartoon, chasing a rodent with the same single-mindedness that Wile E. Coyote pursued the Roadrunner. And in movies like Stripes and Ghostbusters, he defined the laid-back wisecracker persona for a whole new generation of filmgoers and imitators. It was right after succeeding so wildly in those comedy films that Murray tried making the transition to drama as the star of The Razor's Edge. That attempt failed, but that was 20 years ago. Now he's gotten rave reviews and an Academy Award nomination for Best Dramatic Actor for his starring role in Lost in Translation. He plays Bob Harris, an American actor visiting Japan to film a commercial. He's all alone and feeling out of place. And so is a young woman named Charlotte, who's in town accompanying her photographer husband and killing time by hanging out in a bar. These two isolated characters end up confiding a great deal to one another.
What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard. We used to have a lot of fun. Lydia would come with me when I made the movies, and we would laugh about it all. Now she doesn't want to leave the kids, and she doesn't need me to be there. The kids miss me, but they're fine. It gets a whole lot more complicated when you have kids.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's the most terrifying day of your life, the day the first one is born.
Yeah. Nobody ever tells you that.
Your life, as you know it, is gone. Never to return. But they learn how to walk and they learn how to talk and you want to be with them. And they turn out to be the most delightful people you will ever meet in your life.
That's nice.
Terry first spoke with Bill Murray in 1991.
You actually started performing when you were in high school, right?
Well, everybody did, didn't they? I mean, no. I performed in high school just to get out of class. You know, that was the thing. You auditioned for a show, and you would get certain hours off in the afternoon and not have to do homework and, you know, be excused from certain things. Actually, at my school, it was a boys' school. There were girls in these shows, so you could get out. And you even got to rehearse at night, which was really insane.
So musicals? What did you get to be in?
Well, that was the Music Man was the big one, because it was great because we had to rehearse for months to learn all these dance numbers and vocal numbers, and to work with girl dancers from Sacred Heart, you know, the high school girls. And these were like rich girls from downtown who drank, you know, like gin out of 7-Up bottles and stuff. So we it was that was the best job I ever had, I think.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you. You were a dancer in the Music Man?
Yes, I was a dancer.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine you dancing in the chorus of a high school musical.
They wanted somebody who was big enough to lift up this one girl dancer, and they couldn't. The other people that auditioned, I walked by, and the auditions were going on, and there were a couple of very pretty girls in there. So I just walked in there, and they said, you know, and I literally just did just to see what was going on, and I was like the biggest guy by about 5 inches. So they said, you're going to pick up the big girl, you know. And she was big. You know, I had to pick her up on my shoulder. She was large. It was just typecasting. It could have been Lou Ferrigno got the job. You know, he would have, yeah. Lou Ferrigno, you're a dancer? Yes, I am, you know, at once. I mean, it was really all about getting somebody up on your shoulders. But I don't regret it. Yes, I was a dancer, Terry, yes. And I still go out and dance every once in a while, although I don't do it on the Broadway stage.
Oh, I just know High School Musicals had just the corniest choreography.
Well, actually, ours was just the rote one that came with the Music Man book. It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. So we were sort of doing pretty much the Shapoopy number from the musical.
Now, in the movie Tootsie, I think you improvised a lot of this role, but you played a very self-involved, kind of experimental playwright. Did you know a lot of people like that in theater?
Self-involved?
Yeah, what could I possibly be thinking of?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I always, guys whose art was so precious that it couldn't be explained to people, you know, really, and asking a question was like, oh, man, if you don't get it, you know, that kind of thing. It was always, I always enjoyed that, you know. I enjoyed meeting like people like that because it gave me an opportunity to unleash, you know, the darker side of my own wit upon them, you know. And you just wait, and you could sit with them for an hour and a half, and then finally there'd be that opening, and then you could just put a dagger right through their gut, you know. Because anyone that, you know, that attitude was just, it just invited trouble. But some of the things I said is that self-involved guy, I really do believe, you know. So I was just being a drunk and obnoxious guy, but some of the things were really true, just like these guys that I would meet, you know, had some things to say.
Well, what's something that you said in Tootsie that you really believed in, but was also kind of funny and ironic at the same time?
I wanted to have a theater that was only open when it rained.
You genuinely did?
Yeah. Well, I said that in the movie. Oh, I said I wanted to have a theater that's only open when it rains. And I believe that from my own experience in the theater, that the best audience you could ever have even was not a full house, but a house that was three-quarters full because of a very bad, or half full because of a very bad storm, which had kept people away and they hadn't bothered to come, and they would come in still shaking the water off their shoulders and their heads and their hats, and they'd still be wet. Their hair would be wet on the back of their neck because it grounded them in a reality. It made them it put them on the planet. They weren't dreaming. They were really on the planet. So they were ready. the ideal specimens. They lived here, you know.
Bill Murray, speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. We'll hear a more recent interview with Murray in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's hear more from Bill Murray. He spoke with Terry again in 1999 as he was getting raves for his role in the movie Rushmore. That's the name of the private school where Murray, as a self-made millionaire and school benefactor named Mr. Bloom, gets to inspire some students and confuse others. In this scene, Mr. Bloom addresses the student body.
Thank you. You guys have it real easy. I never had it like this where I grew up. But I send my kids here because the fact is, you go to one of the best schools in the country, Rushmore. Now, for some of you, it doesn't matter. You were born rich and you're going to stay rich. But here's my advice to the rest of you. Take dead aim on the rich boys. Get them in the crosshairs and take them down. Just remember, they can buy anything, but they can't buy backbone. Don't let them forget it. Thank you.
I asked Bill Murray if he related to the experience of attending an academy like Rushmore.
I did. I went to an academy. I went to a Jesuit academy in Chicago, in the suburbs, and most everybody had money, and I was one of the ones that did not have money. I worked in the summer, I caddied in the summer, and made enough money to pay my tuition, and then my money was gone. That was pretty much the money I made. So I would go through the school year without sufficient funds. I didn't have a car, and I didn't have, really a wardrobe to speak of. I used to take a lot of abuse for wearing golf shirts to school. Golf shirt, Murray, golf shirt. There were guys who would pimp you for wearing a golf shirt. I had inherited a collection of ill-fitting golf shirts from my older brothers, and that's what I wore to school.
Did you have a complex because you didn't have the money that the other students did, or you didn't have the clothes that they did?
I haven't heard complex in a while.
Me neither. Yeah. I couldn't believe I used the word.
Yeah,
I haven't either.
Heard complex. I had issues.
Issues. That's right.
But I had complex issues there. I guess I had a complex. That's why I tip so heavy nowadays. I think I feel for people that, when I see somebody working in a golf shirt, my hands vibrate. Yeah, it was I guess I had a complex. It sounds worse than it was, but I remember it, and I remember growing up without it, and, I came from a big family, and there wasn't spare dough, and, and I get, think about a couple of weeks ago, I got very upset with my boys, my older boys, because I said, God, you're spoiled rich kids. I'm a failure. I'm a total failure, and, they got very sad, and, well, that's who you are, Dad. That's who you were, blah, blah, blah. But they're actually really sweet guys, and, I was just giving them some tough love. But to grow up without money and now have money is just kind of it's a funny thing. I now loan money to the kids I knew in high school who've blown the money their parents left them, That's a kind of fun thing, But I don't know, to have a complex about it, well, I knew I wanted to pay my own way, and I felt very good to be able to provide my mother with things later in life. And, I remember the first year I made more money in remit runs than my dad ever made, in a year. And I didn't even work. It was just reruns. And
right.
I thought, it's a funny world, funny life. So I grew up that way, the same way this kid grows up in Rushmore, and I could see, and I remember when he said, well, you'd be playing a tycoon. I thought, a tycoon? I'm going to play a tycoon, and the more I thought about it, I thought, well, hell, I am a tycoon. I am a self-made tycoon of some sort, and I got a set of a blue-collar chip on my shoulder, and so that part of it was not hard.
I want to talk about another movie that I think is a really terrific film, and I regret that I think very few people actually saw it. And it's called Mad Dog and Glory. And the screenplay was by novelist Richard Price, who's probably best known for Clockers. And you play a loan shark in this who owns a comedy club and really wants to be a stand-up comic. And you even get to do stand-up as this mobster in the movie. You know a lot about delivery and comedy, but your character doesn't know a lot about it, particularly at the beginning of the film when he's really very stiff. And tell me a little bit about playing a comic who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, I found that mobsters are, the ones I've met, are really funny people. That's part of the paradox is that they're often the most charming people. And the terror of what they're like in their criminal side is almost hard to imagine. But his readings of his lines were had a menace to them. That it was his club. You could be thrown out if you weren't enjoying yourself, enjoying the act. And it gave him a confidence to say it any old way he wanted. And he talked almost like he was talking to his. To his posse, to his own, their group, their gang. And it was an angry kind of comedian, he was angry. He was, he had a chip on his shoulder, and he truly spoke down to his audience.
at the same time was delighting in the fact that he was, that what he was doing and the way he spoke his comedy was now getting public notice. You know, he was charmed with himself. He was really enjoying himself.
Why don't we hear a scene from early in Mad Dog and Gloria where you, the mobster, are doing comedy at the club you own with a lot of your boys in the audience.
Cosa Nostra. Our thing. Our thing, my ass. Cosa Nostra is Italian for cheap bastards. Cosa Nostra babies. Other babies, they're born, they cry, they go, wah, wah. Our kids, they cry. They go, what?
Yeah, he probably heard some comedian sometime say, well, you gotta work with your life. You gotta use your life as your comedy.
Well, in this movie, Bill Murray, you got to work opposite Robert De Niro. And De Niro plays a cop who's a forensic photographer, and he saves your life in a convenience store holdup. And to thank him, you loan him a beautiful young woman played by Uma Thurman, and you basically own this woman because she owes you about $75,000, and she pays it off by doing whatever favor you ask of her. And in this scene from later in Mad Dog and Glory, you've come to pick her up, but De Niro doesn't want her to go because he's fallen in love with her. Let me play an excerpt of this scene.
Bring it down, Wayne.
I love her.
You love her.
I own her! I knew it. Didn't I call it right on the nose when I saw you in the office? You're a schmuck if you don't think she's playing you like a violin right now. Women. F***ing women, you can't live with them. You can't kill them. Okay. If you want, you can assume the debt.
Assume the debt?
Yeah. Be my friend. For what, I don't exactly know. You're a cop. Maybe something, maybe nothing. You want me to forget about her. For the next year, if I call you, you have to pick up the phone. That I can live with.
Bill Murray, what was it like to work opposite Robert De Niro? And I'm thinking, you know, you're such a verbal guy and you're so good at improvising, and De Niro seems much less verbal.
Well, he is less verbal, but he's also he's a hardworking guy and he's serious about his job. I tend to, like, keep it light and goof around on the set just so I'm relaxed. And that got a little distracting for him at one point. I remember one day thinking, oh, God, he was like, yeah, can we just do this here now? You know, so... But we've become friends. I like talking to him. You know, I think he likes my verbal qualities, and I like his sort of surprising sense of humor. And I delighted in really pushing him, you know, and getting him, like if he was supposed to be angry in a scene and I was behind the camera, I would infuriate him. I would enrage him, you know.
How?
Well, I mean, he's a man who demands respect. That's one thing. He you have to respect him. And if you disrespect him, he goes crazy. You know, he will really not like you, you know. But in character, you could get away with that. You could disrespect him, and it would enrage him. And he's, you know, he's very proud of his heritage, too, you know. And if you somehow didn't respect the heritage, you would see something happen in his eyes that was just terrifying, really scary. So if you called him, you know, used an Italian slur of some sort, he would just... He could not control himself. It's, you know, because it, you know, he grew up, where he grew up in the downtown, you know, there was an Italian neighborhood, and they, you know, they were, you know, they had their turf, and they were very protective of their own, you know. Anybody from the outside was a potential troublemaker, and those insults were a or a throwdown, you know? And you don't speak that way. If you spoke that way, you're just asking for real trouble, you know, and it had to be responded to, you know?
Bill Murray speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Murray is up for an Academy Award for his starring role in Lost in Translation. We'll hear more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bill Murray. When she spoke with him in 1999, she asked him about his role in Kingpin, which is directed by the Farrelly brothers, who also directed the raunchy comedies Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber.
They have more fun making movies than anybody I've ever worked with. It really is a riot. They will not stop at any, they will go to any length.
Yes, exactly right. They won't stop at anything. And were there times when you decided, no, that's too broad, we ought to stop here?
Well, I didn't see everything that was in the movie. And when I finally did see the movie, I was, oh, God, I went, holy cow. I was happy with all my stuff because I did all my stuff. But the stuff I hadn't seen, I was just, oh, man, oh, God. You know, it was rough. The first scene of the movie is so rough. And I'd taken my boys, and they were, I don't know, I thought it'd be okay to take them to this movie. I mean, I think they were like 14 and 11 or 13 and 10 or something. And they were shocked, really shocked. I mean, the first scene of the movie involves, sex with an extremely unflatteringly painted woman, you know. Not a painted woman, but a woman that's made to appear just almost like grisly, you know. And there, it's like retching and terrible. And I was stunned into total, like, ice, goose flesh, hair standing up on your skin, silence through the entire movie. And I left the movie theater thinking, oh, my God, what have I done taking him to this thing? And we walked in silence from the movie to the car, which was in an underground parking lot. We must have walked 3/8 of a mile. And my 10-year-old finally said, you were good, Dad. It was really sad. I felt like, you know, the child services was going to come and, you know, take me in. You took them to that? But so their taste goes beyond mine. You know, I wish I could work with them all the time and have Final Cut, you know, because I'd say, okay, just, we don't have to do this one here, but all this stuff, they have so much funny stuff that they do.
I'm going to ask you to choose a scene that you improvised in part from Kingpin.
Oh, well, I don't know. There's one line that I improvised I don't know if this is a play on the radio. There was a scene that I improvised the one line of, and it's a scene where I'm eating breakfast with Woody. And this guy just hits on anybody. He's like is it a peccary? Is that this animal that's in the zoo? It's kind of a small-time pig that they can, it's one of the few animals they have in Central Park Zoo is a peccary. And they have a thought, and then they want to mate. And then they have a thought, and then they want to mate. It's pretty much, that's their pattern. But this guy was like that, where his impulses were basically, I'm fed, and now a woman, please, you know. So I did this, I just sort of made up this line where it's just, and it's a horrible offensive line, but it's my standard of offensiveness and to show to, you know, as opposed to theirs. Just
okay, let's hear the scene.
It'll, this will offend my people out there, people on my wavelength.
This is Bill Murray in Kingpin.
Young bowler like yourself, the tour can be very difficult, very expensive.
Tanqueray and Tap.
Keep them coming, sweets. I got a long drive. Do me a favor, will you? Do you mind washing off that perfume before you come back to our table? A little bad luck. If you had it today, all of your dreams can go up in smoke. That's why even we veteran bowlers, we work our way from tournament to tournament. We need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra. That's what it means. You interested?
Interested?
Interested. Would you be interested in some extra income?
No, extra income.
You want to make more money? Okay. Why don't you go eat that outside and then come up back in. Hi.
Hello.
Not you. Hi.
Hi.
That's a scene from Kingpin, which was made by the Farrelly brothers, who also made Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber. And just in case our listeners couldn't make out the final words of that scene, can you tell us what you were saying to the women at the next table?
I said, no, not you. You.
Right.
It's just a guy who's hitting on women at the next table, and one woman responds and goes, no, not you. You. I mean, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the lady next to you. And it just came into my head at that moment, and it was so horrible, such a horrible thing to say, that there was a moment of complete disbelief, and then everyone laughed really hard because it was, you know, the guy should be taken out and shot. You know?
I know you have to go, so I'll just ask you one more question. Mm. Are you ever able to kind of sneak into lounges and watch lounge singer types?
Well, they usually catch me after a little while, and sometimes they get extremely nervous. Even the music, especially the musicians backing up, because they're like, oh, God. Because the guy performing may not get it anyway. You know, he may not be a... They're often... I shouldn't say get it, but I mean, they're often in their own little world, you know, so they don't even...
They actually think they're good.
They're out, yeah, and they're out of focus to the audience anyway. They don't really see. So it's fun to see the musicians behind them, and they'll spot me and go, oh, God. You know, and they'll be embarrassed because they are backing up a guy that is the guy that I did on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And they'll be, like, winking, going, yeah, it's as bad as you say, and we got to do this every night. It's funny.
Well, Bill Murray, it's really been a pleasure. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I enjoyed talking to you, too.
Well, good night, everybody. And this is Nick Summer saying, a Minnehaha summer is a fun summer. That's what you're here for. That's what I'm here for. I am a fun guy, and I hope that you had fun tonight. Saying one more thing. I want you just to remember to sing. That's right. Sing a song. Sing it loud. Sing it short. Remember to put on some 612 when you go out. Sing it happy, not sad. You know, we got bears over the garbage dump. Just flash your headlights. Sing of the good times and not the bad. Well, no matter if it's not good enough. This is my seventh summer up here for anyone else to hear. Just sing. Sing a song. Please, won't you sing me a song? Thank you. Good night.
Bill Murray speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Murray is up for an Academy Award for his role in the film Lost in Translation.